The U.S. defense industry is large, complex, and competitive. It is also lucrative for those companies able to navigate it successfully. The American Society of Military Comptrollers helps bridge the gap between the boardroom and the battlefield while supporting transformation in the defense sector. The Business of Defense podcast brings you inside the companies working to achieve this directly from the business leaders and to understand how they create value for their companies and their customers. For more information on ASMC, visit asmconline.org.
You're listening to Serious Inquiries Only.
Hello and welcome to Serious Inquiries Only. This is episode 208. I'm Thomas Smith. That over there is Jamie Lombardi. How are you doing, Jamie?
I'm great, Thomas. How are you?
I am good. We have so much to talk about. I don't even know how we're going to do it. We're probably not going to do it all. We'll probably just do what we do and then we'll see. Got some great email, voicemail, all that good stuff. But before we get to that, I was thinking maybe we just chat a little bit about some of the Me Too stories in the news. Because that's always fun. It's always a chance for us to feel great about society and all that and feel positive, cheer up, right?
Yeah, always an easy, breezy, light conversation. talk about rapist Supreme Court justices. So that's fun.
A lot of people are going to complain. Attempted rapist Supreme Court justice. You got to be very, very careful with his feelings, apparently. But anyway, the weird thing happened. I know this was somewhat old news. I think it happened, I want to say maybe over the weekend. Yeah, I guess it was the Sunday Review. So the New York Times, it was so bizarre. They sort of broke a news story, but in their book review article, like someone wrote a Sunday Review about a book that talked about the Kavanaugh stuff. And like, so what happened is the actual news could have and should have been, oh, there's a, not only is there another accusation against Kavanaugh, but here's some critical stuff for everybody while we're at it. A lot of people were there. They did talk about it at the Times. There also was, there also was somebody who said they tried to get a hold of the FBI during this alleged quote-unquote investigation of Brett Kavanaugh during this time, and the FBI never even returned their call. So, like, that was a bullshit investigation. It didn't do anything. All the people out there yelling, well, let's wait for the investigation. We gotta, you know, that's what you do. Nominate Brett Kavanaugh, and then this happens, and then you wait until the FBI says, oh, we checked it, and it's fine, and then it's all good. You know, like, I think this shows the limits of that system. So there's that. And that's not even getting to the fact that this happened, A, on this Sunday Review article, which is weird, the section, rather. And then, B, the New York Times decided to tweet out the worst tweet ever talking about it that framed it in this bizarre terms do you have in front of you, Jamie? What did they decide to tweet?
Having a penis thrust in your face at a drunken dorm may seem like harmless fun. But when Brett Kavanaugh did it to her, Deborah Ramirez says it confirmed that she didn't belong at Yale in the first place.
What?
I just want to say, having a penis thrust in your face when you don't want a penis in your face is not fun, according to any definition of the word that I'm familiar with. Not at all.
Yeah, I love the logic, and I mean this sarcastically, I love the logic of that is like, look, we all think this is harmless, but did you know that like some people don't like this or it might make someone feel like they don't belong at Yale? It's like, oh my God, what in the world? And I guess while I have this in front of me, I thought I had the tweet, but it turned out I didn't. That's why I asked you. Thanks for reading that. But I have the New York Times like little response to it. It's just very brief here. The Times has since deleted and apologized for an offensive tweet that published with this essay from the Opinion Desk's Twitter account. Can you say, this is like a Q&A or whatever, and it says, can you say anything more about how such an inappropriate tweet went out and what, if anything, is being done to prevent that from happening again? And the answer is, the opinion section, like other parts of the Times, has a process for writing and editing social media copy. In this case, the process was not followed properly, resulting in a tweet that fell well below our standards. The department is reviewing with everyone involved, including me, what went wrong to determine how we can avoid similar mistakes. So, like, pretty much not really anything, but that's their statement on it. Yeah, how does that happen?
I have no idea. You would think that they just discovered Twitter yesterday, and that there were no standards in place. And just in light of the larger, you know, socio-political context that we're living in, where the president of the United States regularly refers to the press generally and the New York Times specifically as enemy of the people, it's particularly egregious to me that they were this careless.
Yeah.
With their coverage of a Supreme Court justice. It's almost as though they want to make it easier for him to talk about fake news and the irresponsibility of journalism.
Yeah, and I know there is to a certain extent a bureaucratic problem here in that these are two different like departments of the New York Times. So like they didn't talk to each other. The fact that one had some news, but it was within a book review. So then whatever. And they eventually like the news came out, you know, like that. And that's the important thing here from my perspective anyway, is that this should be out there, that there's this like very credible accusation that was verified by people. Like, I think it said 7 people remembered it and they were willing to talk to the FBI, but the FBI didn't follow up. Like, that's huge bombshell news. And that should have been the headline everywhere. This asshole attempted rapist should not be on the Supreme Court. And I know it's not going to happen. It's another one of those things where, you know, you're not going to have the votes to impeach Trump and you're not going to have the votes to do this, whatever. I am very happy with the candidates who have come out and said we should impeach Kavanaugh, because we need to just fight for what we think should be happening and stop doing the thing where we first decide whether or not it will be accomplished. And then like once we say, well, it won't be accomplished anyway, so I'm not even going to try. We need to stop doing that as a party. So I'm very happy with the candidates who have emphasized that. And I think they should both emphasize impeaching Trump and Kavanaugh. I think that's something we can run on. I think Democrats can be the party of let's not have rapists, maybe. What do you think?
Yeah, I mean, I would be really excited for that sort of development. I think especially after what Mitch McConnell did with holding a Supreme Court seat hostage for a whole year, we really need to be honest with ourselves that most of these rules are largely made up and continue to be in place out of convention and not out of actual necessity. And so I completely agree with you when you say things like, oh, maybe we should decide on what's right before we decide on what's possible.
Yeah.
The Democrats need to find a backbone and need to start actually drawing lines in the sand and standing for things and at least attempt to win a fight before they throw their hands up in the air and give up.
Totally agree. I think, I listen to Pod Save America, and one thing they say a lot on things like this is get caught trying. And I really believe that. I think gone is the day and age in which we can say, oh, well, we tried this and it didn't pass, so now that's going to we're going to take a hit for that. Like, I think that's all priced in. I don't think it makes any fucking difference. We'll just have this be an explicit episode because I think there's more pissed off stuff to talk about. I don't think it makes any fucking difference whether or not we try to impeach Kavanaugh and fail versus we try to impeach him and like it actually works out somehow. I think all the polarization is pretty much priced in. I really think that like there's very little. And if anything, if you can say like, okay, trying to impeach Kavanaugh and Trump maybe turns off some, you know, hypothetical middle of the road voter somewhere. Okay, maybe like that could be true, but not doing it is really going to turn off a lot of potential voters who are on the far left or even anywhere in the left who are going to be pissed off that you're not trying. So for all we know, those offset each other. Go ahead.
So I agree with this. And I don't even think it's about voters on the far left, of mm-hmm. which I kind of count myself as one of them. I think it's also those 40% of voters who just don't bother to come out because mm-hmm. it all just seems like it doesn't matter. And those are the people that we really need to be reaching. And I think this is a place where Democrats shoot themselves in the foot over and over and over and over again. They're so worried about picking off Republican voters or moderate voters or independent voters that they don't spend enough time thinking about, oh, like, what could we do to reach those 40% of registered voters who don't bother to show up on election day? And I think a good place to start might be the courage of your convictions that, like, alleged rapists don't belong on the Supreme Court. That's like, that seems pretty like low-hanging fruit to me.
Me as well. And so there's another take I have of this that I'm going to try out here, and please feel free to disagree, but this is certainly a it's kind of a personal hobby horse of mine. So it's, I'm going to combine two things. So A, there was this, and there was a large, you know, vocal sort of movement on social media of like, delete your New York Times subscription because of this tweet. And then pair that with also, I, after the last debate that you and I watched and reacted to, hope everybody caught that. It was a lot of fun, our little post-debate episode. But right after that, I shared a Washington Post article that, and you probably saw it as well, that was like, Joe Biden had the debate he needed, which I guess was done, maybe like some sort of phonograph poll was done. And then everybody said, like, they had their little like ear horn things that like, they're like, yep, sounds good. And I, you know, I want to be clear here, and I'm not trying to like criticize anybody too much for this, but like I had a lot of responses on that. They're like, oh, that's the establishment media trying to get something such and such to happen. They want Biden to happen because of all this. And I just, I don't know, for me personally, again, Jamie may disagree and that'll be fun. We can argue about it. But I think we put way too much stock in what an author for some of these gigantic news organizations says. And we can certainly question, especially since the Washington Post is owned by Jeff Bezos or whatever, like we can question what might be some editorial biases they have, certainly, absolutely. But when it comes to this, like the New York Times thing as well, I am a proud subscriber of both the New York Times and the Washington Post. And nothing is in the immediate future changing that, because I guess the point I want to make is these are large organizations. And I think that while it is really cool that there has been this democratization of, in some ways, the media and, you know, commentary, and like there's YouTube, there's our friggin' podcast that we have going here, where previously, you know, you and I probably wouldn't have had a voice anywhere. But now that the internet allows everybody to have a voice, and there's been a battle that has, you know, that has taken a toll on some of these major press organizations. But I, for one, still think there is a ton of value in someone like the New York Times, who have the resources to have people embedded in all these different countries, to have bureaus in the Middle East and in Europe and in, you know, for Brexit, for all this stuff, and doing reporting that is frankly way better than, you know, you or I on YouTube is going to be able to do. It just is. And I strongly believe in that. And I subscribe to the New York Times proudly to support that kind of journalism. And their opinion section is a fucking mess and it drives me nuts. And I will agree with basically every criticism of that, but they are so much bigger than that. And so I guess I just wanted to push it back a little on the cancel your New York Times subscription because of this shitty tweet, which was absolutely terrible. But that's there you go. That's my piece. What do you think?
Yeah, you know, so it's kind of boring for me when I agree with you. So I'm going to need you to work harder to be wrong.
All right, I'll try.
But I think that that's, you know, mostly right. I think it's a really short-sighted strategy, especially given the moment that we're living in, to say cancel your New York Times subscription. If you are going to be engaging in a course of action that furthers the advancement of fascism, you're on the wrong side. You're making a bad choice. And the New York Times is clearly not a perfect actor. They are clearly susceptible to biases. They are clearly motivated by their bottom line and making a profit, and that certainly skews how they report and what they report. And those are all things to be mindful of. But like you said, if the New York Times dries up with subscription and runs out of money, we aren't going to get the sort of coverage we need to make meaningful sense of the world and how these different geopolitical conflicts that we have relate to one another and how they can be solved. And that's something that you and I on a podcast can't do.
Yeah.
We aren't going to be able to have the structural support that we need to do investigative journalism. We're just
I speak
not.
Barely one language, I'll be honest. Barely one language. I don't have I can't be reporting on other countries. I can't do it.
Right. And so they provide a necessary service, albeit in a way that is flawed because of the constraints of the world that we live in. But I think saying that you're going to cancel your New York Times subscription is just like, you know, it's a little too chilly in the house. I'm going to set it on fire. Like, it's just not at all proportional or appropriate.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well said. And I very much want to say that the opinion section is really fucking killing me lately. And it's also, this is just off the cuff here, but I did read something recently about how it's actually relatively new that they bothered to do this thing where they try to have all these Republican or conservative commentators. Like, it used to be the opinion section was opinion, but it was within a range of opinion that was still pretty liberal because facts are pretty liberal, you know. And then there's like a lot of pressure in the, I think it was the 70s and 80s to, you know, hey, no fair. You're not allowing these idiots like Bret Stephens in or whoever it would have been at the time to spout crap that is not supported and is really, honestly, the epitome of snowflakery. When you talk about Bret Stephens, if a single person criticizes him, he loses his mind. And so they've
emails
really,
their dean or their provost of their university. Oh, my God. Don't even.
So crazy. And that's unfortunate. And it absolutely it sucks. And I hate it. But it is a very big organization. And I don't want to throw out the baby with the bathwater because it is important to have good, professional, well done journalism in the world. And it really is under threat because of a lot of things, not just Trump or anything. And we don't have to pretend like the New York Times is the resistance voice or anything. I think that was a little unhealthy. That happened a lot with some of these media sources in the wake of the Trump election. They aren't like some, you know, political resistance. They aren't, but they can do good journalism and they can also do some really bad things that we can criticize them for. And that's how I feel. Okay. So maybe we should get to the other bit of Me Too news, which is probably in some ways more disturbing. I don't know. It's hard to say. I guess I don't really need to rate it. But at any rate, when I heard this daily podcast, it was actually today as of recording, about how Gloria Allred's daughter, and then also apparently there's a part two tomorrow about how Gloria Allred was involved. So I don't have that yet, but her daughter was involved in. Well, do you want to talk about it? I know you read the story as well. So do you want to break down?
Why don't you give the setup and then I'll okay. rage.
Well, it sounds as though largely because of a movie deal that happened wherein, you know, the Weinstein Company was going to make Gloria Allred's daughters, and I'm sorry, I can't remember her name. She has a different last name, and I am blanking on it now. But
it's with a B, I think.
Yeah, and it's she has also, you know, also has worked with a lot of victims, as has Gloria Allred. Like, Gloria Allred has been kind of an icon of sorts for working with victims as a feminist and trying to, you know, fight for justice for them. And so it's like even more disturbing to find out that her daughter, who is, again, like I said, worked with her and done some of the same work, because of like a movie deal that the Weinstein Company had for her book, was apparently gung-ho on defending Weinstein and like revitalizing his reputation. This was in 2017. So this is not now necessarily, although who knows what's going on now. But this was like in 2017, like right as soon as Weinstein was tipped off about the kind of the New York Times investigation and the Ronan Farrow investigation. During that time, he not just enlisted her services, she was like proactively trying to work for him. And like so some of the evidence that they have is this document that she prepared where she's like, here's the strategy we'll do to try to defend you. And it involves just like stuff that frankly is really disturbing because it uses her knowledge of victims and their mindsets and stuff and like her history to kind of very effectively gaslight Weinstein's victims. And it's shocking and shitty. And it really makes me despair. what were your thoughts about it? I don't know if I covered all that, but it also, by the way, just to throw that in case people are wondering about the sources for all this, they also have all the billing information in which, you know, and legal billing has to be very detailed because it's one thing we talked about on opening arguments, the one way lawyers can actually get in trouble is by abusing retainers and stuff like that. So like they have the legal billings for what the services they did are. And it's just, it's shocking. The kinds of stuff that she was willing to do for Weinstein. So what were your thoughts on that mess?
So this is so gross and so sadly not surprising. And it's similar to a point that Kate Mann makes in her book Down Girl that I've referenced a number of times and is always kind of on my right.
This might as well
side.
Just be the Kate Mann like fan podcast.
Yeah, I'm like the Kate Mann prophet on this podcast. But you know, she talks about how misogyny doesn't need to be about, you know, individualized hatred of women. And in fact that in this often impedes our ability to understand the way that it functions as a system. Because in this is a clear case of where aligning oneself with the misogyny and the patriarchal structure is an effective strategy for self-improvement, or self-improvement's the wrong word, but self-promotion. And so there was a willingness on the part of Gloria Allred's daughter to participate and be complicit with these misogynistic patriarchal structures because she benefited from them. Mm-hmm. And this is exactly how misogyny functions. It's totally fine, right, to be a woman so long as you are perpetuating the aims of the patriarchy, so long as you're perpetuating the goals of the hierarchy as it's established. And then you can benefit. Misogyny comes about when you try to circumvent or upend that system as a form of punishment. And so long as you're willing to work with it, as we see many of the newscasters on Fox News, for example, you can be held up as a good woman. You can have the professional advancement that you want, so long as you're supporting patriarchy, even if you yourself don't have any internalized hatred for women. You're just operating within the confines of the system because you have to navigate the world as it is, or so it seems.
Yeah, and it reminds me of just how humans are, you know? I really think it's just all too easy when you know, all of a sudden someone's going to make your book into a movie and all this stuff. Like, maybe it's easy to kind of, I don't know, your cognitive biases kick in and it's like, okay, maybe this person is lying about them, and kind of do some self-deception maybe to be on the wrong side of things. I think that, I don't know, humans are very fallible, including me, including everybody. And it's just kind of a reminder of that, I guess.
Yeah, I definitely, and I've said this before, I think cognitive dissonance is one of the most powerful forces on Earth. I mean, if we could harness that, we could, you know, forget nuclear power, we could solve the climate crisis. And I think there's a lot of that in there. You know, very often when people are good to us, we want to be able to uphold them as somehow good, right? And we saw this with Brock Turner, for example, friends of his, and they love to hold up, you know, women to do this, to invalidate the words of other women. Women would get up there and say, well, he can't be a rapist. He's my friend. And well, actually, no, the fact that he's your friend has no bearing on whether or not he's a rapist. And it's quite possible that someone could be perfectly fine to you and absolutely awful to other people. And that we seem to be very uncomfortable navigating those nuances where the people that we know or that we like or that are in a position to benefit us are actually really terrible fucking people and need to be held accountable for it.
All right. Well, after all that, I think we can finally get some listener questions, which is, but I think that's good. I those are stories that I wanted to chat with you about, and it's sort of a Me Too newsy update kind of thing. So we've gotten a lot of listener feedback on all kinds of topics, one of which, it seems that a lot of people are interested in universal basic income and in Andrew Yang. We've got a few comments about that. I'm going to smash these voicemails together. Now, just quick note, this is just a production thing that's kind of tough. It's very difficult to like share these voicemails between us. So Jamie hasn't heard these before. So I'm going to do her the favor of I'm going to play them and then I'm going to comment first. And Jamie, feel free to just tune me out while you form your thoughts. You know, either way, that'll give you some time to process and relate them. But I didn't want, you know, I wanted to let people know just in case. So I'll speak first since I've gotten to review them a little bit. So here's an older UBI one that's short, and then I'm going to combine it with a newer UBI voicemail we got that's about Yang and UBI. So here we go. Here's the first one.
Hey Thomas, this is Brad. I just want to say it's good to have you back, man. I really do appreciate the research that you do. I was wondering if I could get your thoughts on the claim that universal basic income could change society's mindset from a mindset of scarcity to a mindset of abundance, you know, reduce and effectively work to reduce the polarity we're seeing, the deep polarity we're seeing in the country right now. All right, thanks again. Bye.
All right, and here's the second one.
Hi, Thomas and Jamie. This is Pasquale from the Scoring the Strange podcast. I thought I would just chime in real quick about episode 203 when you guys talked about Andrew Yang, particularly his UBI proposition. And, you know, it occurred to me when you guys mentioned that the people with the highest incomes, the millionaires, the amount of money we'd be spending to give them $1,000 a month, it really occurred to me that this whole idea really works against the concept of a social safety net, because it's sort of just bumping everything up a notch without actually addressing the problem, which, again, you guys did mention. But I think that the way to implement something like this would be, rather than worry about giving everyone money, is making sure everyone meets a minimum income. So, you know, if someone's working for $8.25 an hour, you know, 40 hours a week, you know, that's like $17,000 a year. Well, you know, then let's apply some kind of bump to their income, give them checks every month to bump them up to $30,000 a year or something. So that way, at the very least, you know, you could work any job and still survive. And then you could adjust that for families. You know, it would be great if they could do that for like part-time students or part-time workers with children, you know, single parents, or even a two-parent household where you could have a parent at home, you know, more often or all the time. But at the just always adjusting so that everyone can live a minimum lifestyle. And I think mathematically it works out, because if you take, you know, the top 50% of earners out of the equation, you can apply that savings to bumping up the bottom. So people that can't work, people who are having trouble finding work, or people who are working, you know, jobs that just don't pay enough to survive, everyone can at least meet a minimum standard of living. And right now, you know, the state of welfare just, it doesn't address that well enough. We don't spend enough money on welfare, even though, you know, the Republicans would have us believe differently. And I think that, you know, really we just need to roll that all into a single system that allows people to just live comfortably at any income level, or at least be able to survive with some level of comfort. And ultimately, I think, you know, that has to be paired with universal health care, you know, and if we had those two things implemented, I think we'd really be on track to start addressing some of the major issues with poverty and inequality in this country. Anyway, thank you very much. Hope you guys keep this stuff up. I've really been enjoying these episodes lately.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, thanks for both of those. I on the first one, it is very brief, but I wanted to include it because I always love playing voicemail from listeners, and any excuse to include one that I didn't get to at the time. But I like the phrase a scarcity, a kind of a society of scarcity to a society of abundance. I do, you know, we've said some critical things of Yang, but I think I've said pretty consistently that I really do like a percentage of what he says, and sometimes it's a high percentage. There's always a little weirdness in it to me, and we've discussed his kind of his odd, you know, intellectual dark web / alt-right appeal. It's kind of weird to me. It weirds me out, and there are ways that he signals to them that I don't like. But, you know, I think we both said we'd vote for Yang over Biden in a heartbeat, right? It's not like we're you know, huge Yang haters, I don't think. I certainly am not. And, you know, I think a lot of his ideas are bold and visionary. I don't think – so I do like the idea of UBI in terms of moving us from a society that thinks of things in terms of the scarcity to abundance, because, you know, we really do have an abundance of resources on the whole. Like, if you look at all of – the United States and forget that it's where it's concentrated, you know, where wealth is concentrated, we do have a tremendous amount of wealth. And, you know, this is a point that Jamie's made. This is a point that a lot of people have made. We somehow only think about the cost when it's doing something good, like paying for healthcare or paying for college or reducing debt or whatever it is. When it comes to blowing stuff up or fighting wars, we just don't even care. We have the mindset that's like, well, whatever it takes, we'll spend trillions of, oh my God. You know what I saw, Jamie? Then I don't know if you came across this, it was random, but I saw a breakdown of the amount of money on these endless wars we're in for the last, what is it, 18 years or whatever?
Almost 20 years.
Yeah. The amount of money, well, no matter how you stack it up, it's insane and it's disgusting. But the amount of money per death, like per people we've killed, it was like $20 million or like $2 million or something, like it was on the order of millions. I can't remember if it was two or 20. But it was something like that for like, hey, not only have we killed all these people, you know, like we've killed just hundreds of thousands of people, we've also spent, you know, something like $1 million or $2 million at least for each of those people that we've killed. Like to add insult to injury in terms of the horrible things we're doing. Like we're spending so much money to do not good things.
And then to just rub some salt in the wounds, according to all of our intelligence agencies, this has contributed in no way to actually making us safer.
Right.
So we've just set this money on fire while at the same time saying, like, oh, we just can't pay for healthcare, education.
Right.
So stupid.
I do like, in terms of that first voicemail, it would be nice if we could switch that mindset to where, you know, when it comes to our healthcare, when it comes to school, when it comes to all these things, housing policies, where we're like, hey, we've got a lot of stuff. We got a lot of resources. Let's put them to good use. And then I'd almost wish we could reverse it where it's whenever we want to build a new fucking Star Destroyer, whatever the hell we're doing, then we're like, well, you know what? Really don't have money for this. That would be nice. I would love to flip those things. But I do not think that this will do anything for polarization. I just don't. You know, I imagine, Jamie, maybe you'd agree that like, even if, you know, you say President Yang's in there, whoever it is, and we get some kind of UBI, I don't know how that changes polarization. Now, maybe once people see the benefit of policies like that, like maybe that helps making arguments easier for liberal policies, and maybe that helps polarization a little bit. But I just think the right-wing media outrage machine is just so fine-tuned that I don't know. I don't know what loosens that.
Well, I think, you know, there's certainly a lot of our conflict is driven by this scarcity mindset, right? It's what fuels our current, you know, capitalistic system. And we're not going to solve that by something as simplistic as, you know, a freedom dividend of $1,000. Because as we saw when we dig into the policy, one, this is funded in really regressive ways and is given no strings attached to millionaires, but comes with significant strings and hardships for people who have to rely on government assistance. And so it's not actually going to do anything to address the ever-widening income gap between the rich and the poor. It's going to be great for people who are already above the poverty line. So for me, right, an extra $1,000 a month
probably
is a game changer.
Probably be great for me too,
You know, like I can open my pot cafe that I really want to once New Jersey finally gets around to legalizing
marijuana. I want to do a cat cafe. Could we combine those?
That'd be great.
Okay.
Yeah.
We'll talk about
that. Yeah. Pot cafe while you like pet cats. This is like my ideal life.
All right.
And, you know, under Andrew Yang's policy, like I'm going to win big. But people who need housing assistance or supplemental nutritional assistance aren't going to see a meaningful difference in the quality of their lives. And so they're still going to live with real scarcity. They're still going to live worried about if they're going to be able to feed their children, if they're going to be able to both feed their children and make rent and see a doctor. And so it's not going to structurally change anything. And what's so interesting to me about Yang getting all of this attention for his freedom dividend is that I think Cory Booker actually has a much better policy to address structural intergenerational poverty than Andrew Yang does. And so he's got his baby bonds, right? Which, like Andrew Yang's freedom dividend, are also going to come up against a lot of legislative obstacles. But this actually much more meaningfully deals with structural inequality and intergenerational poverty. Because depending on the tax bracket of the family you are born, it will impact how much money the government continues to invest in your baby bond account. And so someone born into the lowest tax bracket, for example, under Booker's account, is going to end up with close to $50,000 in a nest egg by the time they turn 18, where someone born into the highest tax bracket is going to end up with somewhere around $1,700. And this is much more meaningful to someone than, you know, $1,000 if it comes at the cost of the food you need to live. And I'm surprised that Booker's baby bonds are getting so much less attention than Yang's freedom dividend.
I do like Booker's baby bonds. It's also got alliteration. That's good. That is a good policy. I want to respond I'm sure you saw this too. And I can't remember if we addressed this, but just in case, I'm pretty sure we might not have. But a lot of people responded to the analysis you did on Yang's UBI when you pointed out, here's how much we're going to spend on the just the millionaires, you know, under this policy. And the response was, which I think is something you and I already know, but I think it's worth maybe emphasizing here. The response is, oh, you let everyone have it because it's just politically easier. Then you don't get the means testing, blah, blah, blah. Like, you don't get all you avoid certain arguments. And yeah,
that's
we know
really
all that.
That's a really stupid argument in a country where people are dying of hunger and not having health care. That's just stupid. You can't at the same time pop on a hat with the word math because you want to signal that you're some kind of like serious nerd and then advocate something so stupid. I'm sorry. That's just stupid.
Well, sure. Thank you. And also my response was going to be this, that it seems so weird for a candidate like Yang, who in so many ways is this visionary long shot, you know, out of the box, kind of just different, you know, like he's not a politician. He's a businessman. He's got all these weird ideas that some of which are really cool. And there seems to be no limit to his imagination until you talk about this. And then you're like, well, we need to be able to, you know, we need to be able to pass this UBI. So we're going to adjust it so that we give millionaires a bunch of money so that maybe it'll get complained about. It's just weird. It seems like talking out of both sides of your mouth. If on one hand, he's this bold visionary, he's going to do all kinds of amazing stuff. And then on the other hand, we need to make sure we waste billions of dollars on millionaires and also don't double up the $1,000 and the food stamps that we're giving someone in order to pass this, which is not going to happen anyway. It just seems weird to me. Like, why not make a policy that is, we cut it off. I don't think it would be particularly difficult politically, especially when you're trying to win the Democratic nomination, to say, we don't need to give this money to millionaires. If you make X number of dollars and, you know, do some research, make sure you have a good number that, you know, if somebody's living in a very expensive city that, you know, I don't know, make sure the numbers make sense. So it's not, you're not going to have some counterexample.
Listen, to be perfectly honest, I'm not even inclined to be sympathetic. If you've managed to figure out how to live in San Francisco, then screw you. Until every child in this country has food three times a day, I don't care about how hard it is to live in San Francisco. I just don't until we can feed all of the children. Those are just my priorities.
Well, then maybe that's we tackle that under a different policy. I guess I'm trying to go from the Yang angle. Like if I'm Andrew Yang or a supporter, like I don't understand why it's so hard to set a cutoff to do two things. Say, A, this is only on top of other current programs. We're not going to cut your food stamps for it. And B, we'll cut it off at, $1 million, $500,000, whatever you think it is, $100,000, whatever. And because that'll save a bunch of money. Like people like saving money in policies, right? I just think that would be better for, you know, for the Democratic primary anyway. And maybe, yeah. You know, if you want to make some argument that Republicans like it better when you give millionaires money, okay. But then so many of his policies seem to be progressive in ways that Republicans aren't going to like anyway. So what does it matter if, you know?
Yeah, again, I really can't make sense of the Andrew Yang support. There seems to be other candidates that are arguing for similar things that have better policies that more meaningfully address the problems that Yang's proposals are pitched at. And it seems to me if you can't both be a visionary genius and incapable of coming up with how to give away money that doesn't go into the pockets of people who already have more than they need, while some people are dying from the lack of it. It seems incompatible to me.
Right. And so I guess regarding Pasquale's voice message, which was in sterling audio quality, by the way, I love when a podcaster sends me a voice message. but also, yeah, I've actually often wondered why there isn't a program like that where it's like, okay, it's like a minimum wage, but also the government will help, I don't know, some sort of companies pay an even higher wage by subsidizing it. Off the top of my head, I imagine, you know, it's going to be one of those things where once the government says, okay, we'll pay the gap between such and such wage and such wage, then all the incentives are for corporations and stuff to just pay lower and be like, oh, well, why doesn't the government pay the rest kind of thing? So that's a barrier. I'm sure there's some policy way around that. But
I mean, but isn't that sort of what's happening with Walmart now? I mean, their wages are so low that the majority of their employees have to have their work subsidized by government assistance programs.
Yeah, good point. That is a good point. It is already kind of happening. Yeah. But in a worse way.
In a worse way, because what we do is we shame the recipients of those programs.
Yeah.
We shame the workers who, you know, have their hours, you know, meticulously cut so that they don't go over a certain amount to be entitled to the sort of benefits that the company making record profits year after year would have to pay. We shame them for needing the healthcare subsidy or the rent subsidy or the food subsidy or the housing subsidy. Instead of the government, instead of the company that is intentionally, purposefully exploiting human beings who are working really hard in order to do what they're supposed to do. And it gets at this idea. And I think this is something that Americans just aren't ready to really wrestle with, is our whole conception of how we organize our lives and how we relate to each other and how we make sense of our own value is fundamentally fucked up right now. And we have this sense that we're only valuable or we're only good enough or we only deserve to enjoy our families or our vacations or a good meal if we're worked to death. And that seems to me to miss something really fundamentally important. And I don't think we're going to be able to do what, you know, Brad had said, meaningfully shift our mindset until we tackle the way that we construct our conceptions of ourselves and our values.
Yes, all well said. I when you think about it, it's a great point you make. It's like Walmart and other corporations like that, and maybe Amazon. I think Amazon is, I've read gross. Too much about them lately and it's disturbing. But it's almost as though they are utilizing what few government programs we have to even be able to pay people these awful wages. Like, people wouldn't be able to even do it if not for some amount of safety net. And so they're using what little, you know, government assistance there is to pay people less. And it's sickening. And you might have also seen there's some viral thing recently where someone was like, I'm sorry, I just know that, you know, CEOs work harder than poor people kind of thing. And it's just not true. Like, yes, people who are CEOs, they do work a lot. Like, you know, of course they work a lot. But are you telling me for 1 minute that if they had the option of a workday of like, okay, you get to, you know, maybe you're putting in a long 10, 12 hour day, whatever, at the office as the CEO. Is that harder, or would you rather go pick fucking strawberries all day? You know, like, of course you'd rather work in a nice air conditioned office and be doing pushing paper and that kind of thing. Like, some of this hard labor stuff, you know, I worked in construction in college to try to sort of help pay for that, even though I didn't, and I ended up with more debt. But it probably wasn't even worth doing because you make so little in these shitty summer jobs. But like, hard labor is fucking hard. It's the idea that like people who are barely getting by, whether it's picking whatever it is, crops and doing agricultural jobs, or if it's construction, ditch digging, whatever it is, it's so hard. And like, it's absolutely harder than working some desk job somewhere and making way more money in an air conditioned office. It's just unequivocally so.
Right. And we tend to treat people differently based on how much money they have. And we conflate that with the difficulty of their work. And that's a mistake. And I don't think we're really going to be able to tackle that until we really tackle like what gives human life value.
Yeah.
And that it should be, you know, to the benefit of the person who has the opportunity to live it. And we're not going to be able to do that in a society arranged as we are right now. Because at the end of the day, you know, working hard and having a meritocracy sounds great until you realize like you need somebody to deliver the pizzas. And the person who delivers the pizza should still get to enjoy his life, should still get to be able to relax at the end of the day with his family and have enough money to run the electricity and like order a movie from Amazon. you know, and like even occasionally eat takeout himself. Like there should be an ability to enjoy quality of life, even if you are in a high powered CEO, because the high powered CEO still needs somebody to clean the floors, still needs somebody to tell him which articles he should read in the New York Times so he sounds insightful and learned at his cocktail party. And these people's lives also matter, even though their paychecks are much smaller.
Absolutely. Wow, we're already predictably running out of time, but I do want to read this email. This is interesting. It's a bit of a pivot. It was related to Yang, but I have some thoughts on it. I think it'll be interesting to talk about. This is from John. Don't want to use the last name just in case they want to be anonymous. And John is about as anonymous a name you can get, so that should be good. Besides Thomas Smith.
That sounds made up, to be honest. Yeah.
This was regarding Yang, and it was regarding our episode, I think. And John says, I've been thinking a lot about this and I'm really torn about it. As a white man, I'm also aware that I can't come to accurate conclusions about it alone, but I do care and I really want to understand, be a part of the solution to problems in our society. And side note, I'm trying to put the right context around this. This was about, I think, Andrew Yang's sort of appeal to the right, the alt-right. And we talked about some of the ways Andrew Yang is kind of dog whistling in certain ways. And I think this person, this emailer, as an Andrew Yang fan, is trying to grapple with that. So I'll read on here. Sorry for perhaps TMI, but this is the context of my angst. One of the first things my counselor focused on in my sessions with her is how I hate myself for being white and how I have crippling guilt for feeling like the luckiest person on earth. No matter how whatever I am, I'm even more lucky for the situation I've been born into. It's not fair. I hate myself. I spin my wheels and end up in the darkest corners of my head when I go down this rabbit hole. In the past 2 years, I've come a fairly long way to the point that I'm mostly okay, mostly keep my anxiety under control, and no one other than my partner really knows that I'm struggling. Finding constructive ways to volunteer my time and my skills that I've gained to help those in less privileged positions is also helping. Doing something positive and focusing on solutions feels good to me. Your podcast has me thinking, have I forgotten how lucky I am? Have I gone too far in the other direction? How can I accept a candidate that doesn't lean into identity politics and by doing so implicitly absolves many who are culpable? Am I giving racists and white people who are devoid of empathy toward the injustices of the past and the present exactly what they want? Those aren't happy thoughts, but these are important things to think about. And again, thanks to your podcast for keeping these thoughts present. What is it that we as society should do about this? What should a president do? What can I do? I think that the president should talk about it to try to resolve injustices of the present and remember injustices from the past in order to learn from them. But is that enough? How much should they talk about it? Should they boycott Fox News? How much should they emphasize building empathy instead of proposing policies? Should Andrew Yang talk more about inequalities? Should I not support him unless he does? Should I be upset he cared more about sharing his solutions with Fox News viewers than making sure the Fox propaganda machine doesn't benefit from his appearance? Let me see, here, I'll continue here. While Yang does discuss that the median wealth of black families will go to $0 in his speeches, and he does discuss the gender pay gap, and he does propose many policies around social justice, he does not emphasize it, and he's a solution-driven speaker. I honestly don't know what the right balance is. A goal I think we can all agree on is to have society that moves towards being racially blind. To get there, we have to continue to talk about injustices and find solutions. So there it is. I mean, there's a little bit more there, but he's grappling with that as a Yang fan. I really appreciate this. I think that this is somebody who is being reflective, and I don't know. I don't know about this Yang question in particular. I don't know, Jamie, if you have any thoughts on how much should one be turned off by this kind of downplaying of identity politics Yang is doing. I don't know that I have a good answer for John here, but I wanted to talk about this idea of, I don't know if white guilt's the right word, but you know, it is something that I struggle with, you know, especially with raising kids. I don't know if you have any thoughts on this, but I guess what really does bum me out a lot of the times is how, you know, like my kids, as I'm raising them through no fault of their own, were, you know, born to white parents and will be white and will have privilege. And there's a whole lot of like guilt that's going to come with that, that it's some ways it feels, I don't know, it feels shitty that they have to deal with that. But on the other hand, you know, like, so what's the line between, like, is it helping to feel guilty all the time? Or should we be able to, like, okay, I'm going to do such and such thing, sort of like we do with anything, with the environment, with whatever it is. I'm going to do such and such action and then try my best to just, like, live an otherwise good life and not be constantly beating myself up about certain things, you know? Like, I don't know. I thought it was interesting to think about. Did you have any thoughts on this?
Yeah. So I have a sort of funny response to a very serious question, but I can sort of like hear Dumbledore's voice in my head saying, you know, it matters not what someone is born with, but what someone becomes. And so I think in the first sense, it doesn't really make sense to feel guilt over something for which you're not responsible. Mm-hmm. You know, unless you somehow were able to choose white parents and did so that you could leverage racism to get farther ahead in life, it doesn't make sense to me to say I feel guilty for being white. I think that's different, though, from a recognition that by virtue of the fact that you are born white, you have some systemic advantages that other people will not have for choices that are also no fault of their own. And I think that's important to keep in mind when we talk about the different types of professional success or academic success that we have and how this positioned us. I think very often people have the experience of having worked really hard to get to where they are in life, and that's largely true. But because of, you know, maybe the loans that they had to take on or the late nights of studying that they pulled, they want to feel like that's all theirs, right? And that isn't the result of systemic advantages or disadvantages. And that's where kind of cognitive dissonance can come in and blind us to the way that we aren't necessarily where we are because of merit. We are where we are because our parents were able to pay for college, or because being white or middle class meant that you learned English with a certain affect as opposed to a different one that enables you to pass in environments that you maybe wouldn't have had you been born somewhere else. And so I don't think it's about feeling guilty for choices that you couldn't make, but aware of the way you evaluate people who didn't have those same advantages, and to be more mindful and open to the way that these systems need to be tweaked so that they can be fair.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that's well put. I think when I struggle particularly is, you know, when I read a news story or see some vivid, horrible images of police violence against Black people, it just feels so shitty to just be like, wow, I never have to worry about my kid's safety in that way, really. I mean, most likely, or at least disproportionately. Yes, the police do kill a lot of white people, but like disproportionately, actually Native American number one and Black people number two in terms of the disproportionate effect. But anyway, the difference in that, it's hard not to feel like, I don't know if guilt is the right word, but yeah, just some sort of, almost in a way, like a survivor's guilt in some of these cases, you know, like when we see what's happening with migrants, you know, in these camps, it does feel like, you know, there's nothing, I have this unearned privilege where I don't ever have to worry about
that. And
yeah, yes, yeah.
That I do feel guilty about, because that I feel like I, in that sense, I'm failing to live up to my moral values. Every single day I continue to live in this country and, you know, go out to dinner instead of like laying my body down somewhere to stop this. And I do feel like all of us are responsible for that, because at the end of the day, if we all sort of locked arms and said, oh, you know what? No, not on our watch. We're just going to lock arms and lay down in the streets until this shit stops because it's gross. It would stop. And so every day that we don't lie down in the streets and muck up the highways and the postal routes and stop this, I do think is evidence of our moral failing. And I think that's a place where we do need to be mindful and we do need to be more reflective. It's not as obvious to me as how we can undo centuries of internalized systemic racism. And I think the first step is being aware of it. And I think the first step, and then the step after that is seeing like, okay, where do these things function? How can I leverage the particular skills and talents that I have? You know, I don't know, maybe this caller or the emailer is a lawyer, right? Who can do pro bono defense work for Black people, or maybe he specializes in real estate law, right? And he could do pro bono closings for first-time Black home buyers, right, to sort of offset this in a way that leverages his talents and skills. I don't know. We're probably going to get an email from somebody that I've overlooked something and I'm being racist in my own way, in which case I will have to apologize and reevaluate. But I think it's going to have to do with what your particular talents are and where you can make a difference. Simone de Beauvoir has a line where she talks about if we opened our eyes to all of the suffering in the world, we would weep forever and never be able to actually do anything. And so the answer to this, I think, is to see where you are and to see what you can do. And we all have different talents and we all have different abilities and none of us can do all of it, but each one of us could do something.
I agree with that. I think that this is as much a message to myself as anybody else that I think the sort of the Zen or maybe it would be the Stoic way to look at it. Maybe it wouldn't be Stoic. But anyway, that usually it's something like, you know, feeling some sort of guilt or something like that is good insofar as it's useful. And then after it's useful, like when it borders on destructive to you and is actually like preventing you from being productive in any sort of way, let alone in a way where you could be helpful, then it's no longer useful and you ought to do your best to not go to that length. So I think there's a good equilibrium point where it's like you're aware enough to be motivated. And that involves some really hard, tough, for me, certainly, especially with the news these days, some really tough days, some really sad days, all that stuff. I am not good at this, at the advice that I'm trying to give. But if I were good at it, I would say try to do what you can, like take care of the actions that you can take care of, like you're outlining, Jamie. Do the help in the ways you can help. And for the record, like donating is a great way. If all you can do because you're so busy with your family, with your work, whatever is, oh, I have a few extra bucks to throw to this organization that's going to work on behalf of immigrants, you know, to defend their rights, whatever it is, you know, find a good organization. That's awesome. That is something. That's not nothing. I think, you know, I think it's very laudable. It's doing something, especially if that's all you literally have time for, because everybody has their own struggles that they're going through. So there you have it. Any final thoughts before we draw this episode down to a close?
Yeah, no, I think the Stoics would agree with you. You know, Epictetus says like there are things that are up to us and there are things that are not. And what the only thing that we can do with our time is to focus on the things that are up to us. So if you feel guilty, take stock of what you can control. And if there are things that you can, that are up to you that you can change, then change them. And what you can't change, you have to set aside because that's just not your lot and it's not your fault. And you have to put your attention on what you can change because that's ultimately all that's up to you.
I lied. I do have to say one more thing because I just wanted to.
Oh, I thought we were going to end on Epictetus.
I know we can't. Damn it. Well, once I'm done, you can just say Epictetus and then we'll close. But since the whole point of this email was about Yang, I want to say that for that angle, if you truly believe that Andrew Yang's policies are better for these kinds of groups, whatever, or the country at large or underrepresented groups or whatever it is, if you really think that, then don't feel any guilt about your support of Yang. I just disagree with you. I think that there are other, you know, you outlined Cory Booker. My favorite is Elizabeth Warren. I just think her policies and her qualifications are going to mean she'll be better for these groups that I'm most worried about. And if I am convinced that I'm wrong and somebody else would do better, then I would want to support that person. I don't think there's any there, but if you, I guess my point is, if you truly believe that Yang is like the one way, you know, like the truth and the way and all that stuff, like then that's what you believe, and we should engage on that level and not from some like, oh, I'm guilty that I feel guilty that he's dog whistling to certain groups, but I still think he's going to be best for the country. Well, then whatever. I mean, then you would just vote for him, I think, right?
Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, at the end of the day, that's an empirical question. And I think it's wrong that Andrew Yang is going to have the policies that will be most beneficial to the demographics that this person is writing in to say that they're concerned about. I think that's just false. I think they're just not clearly thought out well enough. I think Elizabeth Warren or Bernie Sanders have better ideas that would more meaningfully impact the quality of life or for the demographics that he's concerned about.
There you go. I will say, before you get to say Epictetus or whatever, I will say, thanks for listening. If you like the show, if you want to hear bonus stuff, and if you want to support, please go to patreon.com/seriouspod. That's where you can support the show, make it happen. Like I said, bonus stuff from time to time. I think we got so much we didn't get to. We'll see if we can record another one, or we'll find some way to address the rest of these questions, because we really, you know, in typical fashion, didn't get to them, but we will find a way. So stay tuned, support the show on Patreon, and thank you so much for listening.
Epictetus.
The first taste of rare bourbon you finally got your hands on. That's nice. At Caskers.com, we make this experience easy. Caskers is a one-stop spirit curator with an impressive selection of exclusive, sought-after, rare, and household names in the realm of premium spirits and champagne. Discover the top flavors of the year now by going to Caskers.com and using code WELCOME10 for $10 off your first purchase. Get $10 off your first purchase with code WELCOME10 at Caskers.com.